Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a good three-day weekend, whatever that meant for you in your circumstances. As you get ready to go for a haircut again, depending on where you live, here's a glimpse of our immediate future from Springfield, Missouri, right in the middle of the country. The story was around this weekend, maybe you heard it. Two hairstylists there in the same hair salon have tested positive for COVID-19 after doing the hair of more than 140 clients. The local health department is sending out contact tracers to try to locate all those freshly shorn and coiffed 140 Missourians. We'll talk more about the hair question and the national implications of the Missouri case later in the show. But in that context, renewed close contact, did you hear what President Trump threatened yesterday? He threatened to move the Republican convention this summer from Charlotte, North Carolina, to some other state unless Democratic Governor Roy Cooper there promises they can do it at what the president calls full attendance and fully occupied. Reopening with full attendance, fully occupied. Full attendance at the Spectrum Center is 17,000 people. And as we hit the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths in this country, and maybe you saw the front page of Sunday's New York Times, it's worth getting lost in for a little while, just reading the names on that full page of names of people who have died and just a little bit about them. Read a little bit about some individuals you don't know who've died of COVID-19. And then remember what President Trump said last week about this country having so many cases.
So when we have a lot of cases, I don't look at that as a bad thing. I look at that as, in a certain respect, as being a good thing because it means our testing is much better. So if we were testing 1 million people instead of 14 million people, we would have far fewer cases, right? So I view it as a badge of honor.
Here's another way to look at that badge of honor, as the president called it. 100,000 deaths in this country out of about 350,000 worldwide. Or another way to put it, the U.S. has 4% of the world's population. We've had 28% of the world's coronavirus deaths. With us now, we are pleased to have New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker. Hi, Senator. It's been a minute. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, I don't feel like it has been because I listen to you a lot, but it's really good to be back on as a guest.
You've got some very interesting legislation in the works that we'll spend most of our time on, but on the convention, do you even understand why the president is calling for a fully occupied basketball arena?
I don't know, and I don't care to try to get into the workings of that mind. He is incredibly combative and does things that suck up attention and media, that fire up his base and outrage his opposition. And I think this is just another example of him spouting off about something that just makes no sense. I care about the health and well-being of all Americans, and those that are gathered there should not be find themselves in a super spreader event. That would be tragic to see those kind of cases break out. And he should listen to public health officials, people within his own administration, people like Dr. Fauci, and listen to what they would say about doing an event like that and abide by it. And God willing, yeah, it's safe to do the Democrat and Republican conventions. But if it's not, he should not endanger people's lives, period.
And later in the hour, we'll invite calls from people who've been Republican convention delegates in the past or know you're going to be one this year or supposed to be one this year. Are you ready for this? Do you want to travel to Charlotte with full occupancy, full attendance at the Spectrum Center where the Charlotte Hornets play basketball and 17,000 people can go? Senator Booker, there was news this weekend that voter registration has really fallen off after being on an upward swing before the pandemic hit. I see you've introduced legislation to expand ballot access for this emergency period. Want to say what's in it?
Yeah, there's to me, the right to vote is just sacred, and exercising that vote is a fundamental right that we should make as easy as possible. And I think that, as you just said, the pandemic has really placed this right in peril. Unless we take really decisive measures, we're going to see a terrible choice for a lot of Americans between protecting their health and participating in the democracy. So one of the things I've suggested, along with a lot of other voter rights security measures and mail voting mail efforts, is something called Democracy Corps, which aims to cultivate and inspire young people in voting and to strengthen our democracy by helping them to execute. In the way that Freedom Summer worked, my bill would create a federal organization modeled off of the Peace Corps, of having 35,000 individuals who'd be deployed to all 50 states, not red and blue counties, and to help administer registration efforts so that we have the full and robust election participation. It's something that all Americans should be excited about and energized by, no matter what your party is. This is something that makes us unique in the face of, from China to Russia to many other nations that don't have this incredible thing called the franchise. So this is just something very common sense and basic that would also help to create jobs during this summer when we see youth unemployment rising to levels we have not seen since they've been measuring it. This would help get a lot of young people involved in a larger effort in our country to register people to vote and have greater and safer participation.
How intense do you think the fight will be over mail-in ballots, which the president is trying to limit with unfounded claims of widespread voter fraud?
Well, the hypocrisy of someone who participates in mail-in balloting, mail-in voting, trying to stop Americans from doing it under the false claims that somehow this is wildly open to fraud. It's just not true. And again, it just is a throwback to the days when you saw people in high elected office working in a concerted effort to deny people the right to vote. And it is so offensive to me at a time that we should be celebrating the franchise and doing everything we can to make it easier to vote. It is dangerous. It is reckless. And to me, it's deeply offensive that a president would be trying to force people to go to vote when it might not be as safe to do that for people who are elderly or have underlying conditions. So in other words, he can vote safely from home, but others, he's going to try to force them into making that unfortunate choice.
He says he votes by mail because he's registered in Florida and lives in the White House in Washington, D.C. And he also says that people with certain conditions, elderly, infirm, you're going to be away, should be able to get absentee ballot. It's this thing like mailing applications to every voter to apply for an absentee ballot like they just did in New York, for example, where he thinks the opportunity is ripe for fraud.
Well, two things. One is, I don't know the exact number of days he spent in Florida, but it seems like that his flying down there is not that much of a challenge. And if this was something he believed in, he would lead by example. Number two is, there, as we saw in Milwaukee, the horrible sight I saw of people being wheeled into voting places, or elderly people or elderly African-Americans who have seen a disproportionate challenge with this virus. But again, the facts are the facts. Objective studies that have seen what are the fraud or the abuse of this have shown that it is de minimis, if at all. And I do not understand, when you have entire states that do this, there are entire states like Oregon that do their entire voting by mail, why we think that this is not a safe, strong system, why he would be trying to undermine efforts to protect public health and to ease access to the vote, as opposed to what he seems to be trying to do, which is to do things that would undermine voter participation and reduce voter turnout, which is so, if there's anything we can say is anti-American, this democracy in which the right to vote has been fought by champions from Alice Paul to John Lewis, for him to do something that would just reverse our strides towards greater voting and voter participation is just ugly to me.
And certainly the example of states like Oregon, as you point out, which a lot of people in the rest of the country don't know, that already do it, and there's basically no incidence of voter fraud. That's a very large sample that puts the lie to what is pretty obviously a voter suppression attempt. You live in Newark. We've all been hearing about the racial disparities in who's getting the virus and who's dying from the virus. Do you see it in your hometown?
I do. I'm standing in my home in Newark right now. And look, this is something that's awful. Me and a few other senators have been calling on the CDC to do better tracking and gathering the data on this so that we can begin as a nation. I hope that this horrors of the disparate impact this has had on everybody from African Americans to Native Americans. What's happened in the Navajo Nation, for example, is truly wretched and tragic. We need to get as much information and data, and we need to expand our circles of empathy to start dealing with the causes of this. And we have a country that unfortunately has dramatic differences in terms of exposures to toxins, whether it's asthma rates in Newark multiple times higher than surrounding suburbs, whether it is access to health care, and the other challenges from even just broken food systems. So I want to obviously deal with this crisis right now. As we expand tracking and tracing capabilities, we should be focusing that on vulnerable communities. But I also believe that we have a lot of sort of a comeuppance as a nation to step up and work towards health outcomes that are not so disparate as they are right now between races in America.
Talk to me about the short term in this respect. I mean, we have to undo the long-term structural racism that has left people so unevenly vulnerable based on uneven economic conditions and healthcare access. But what about the short term? The 100,000 deaths we're marking today came in just 2 months. At that rate, they may be just the first 100,000 deaths. How can we immediately level the field for less disparate impact right now?
And I appreciate that, because a lot of folks ignore that and shift to the larger problem, and that's often an excuse for diffusing urgency and effort. And so right now, we've got to make sure that our healthcare resources, if you have a fire on a block and a multifamily unit is ablaze, we've got to allocate more of our water resources to that area. And so right now, we know the things that help us to contain the outbreak of this virus, and that is vigorous testing, the ability to trace contacts, the ability to get healthcare resources to those people that are in crisis. And those are the things that we really should be focused on doing in communities that are really, really vulnerable. We know we can, and we've seen this from South Korea to successful areas of our country, that we can limit the spread of this virus if we are vigilant. And I appreciate my governor, Murphy, who is very conscious of this and who has a strategy and a plan. But again, I'm frustrated that we do not have a national World War II-like mobilization that includes, you know, when we had an attack in our region that killed thousands of people, we did a national mobilization, hired an army of people. We see them still today, the TSA agents, for example. We should be having the same kind of national response to this crisis that is mobilizing a world class. We're the United States of America. We should have the world class tracing, tracking, and frankly, efforts going on to get therapeutics involved that with things that work, as opposed to our president, who seems to be doubling down on things that we know endanger lives. So this is not beyond our capacity to do something about right now, but we do not see that level of urgency amongst this president. In fact, I think he's acting more like this nation is still governed by the Articles of Confederation, where we have a loose affiliation of states that compete against each other for critical resources, as opposed to a strong federal government that says the buck stops with us. We're going to coordinate. We're going to mobilize. We're going to have supply chains that work. We're going to allocate resources, and we're going to show what the United States of America, this country that put someone on the moon, the country that mapped the human genome, we're going to show what we can do in a crisis like this.
Are there disparities at the hospitals in New Jersey that you think could be addressed somehow? Like, there are stories around where Mount Sinai Hospital in New York is getting all this money from Warren Buffett, and he flew God knows how many N95s from China. on his dime for the Mount Sinai system, while some public hospitals and poor hospitals were launching GoFundMe pages. Are you seeing that kind of thing? And is there something legislators like yourself can do about that?
So there's a big disparity in our country for resources being applied to hospitals. So, for example, in Newark, we have a hospital that has, for a long time, other hospitals around us will send patients to Newark who do not have health insurance. And it's always been a challenge with charity care. Again, my governor has done a lot to try to address that. But a lot of times our urban hospitals that serve the most the most vulnerable populations do not have those kind of networks of philanthropists, of networks of support that other hospitals have built. In addition to that, what we're seeing right now, and again, there are parts of New York that understand this, that are a lot of our rural hospitals that often serve lower income and vulnerable populations are on the brink of going out of closing, because right now, without elective surgeries or limitations on elective surgeries, the hospitals that do not have the cash to survive are facing real challenges. And so, yes, that we need to be focusing in on those hospitals that are serving those most vulnerable populations, making sure that they're not just economically stable, but have the resources they need to more fully meet the crisis. And that also includes things, the treatment for underlying conditions that are that threaten somebody should they get COVID as well. And that means everything from diabetes to hypertension and a lot of those underlying conditions that make a person more vulnerable should they get COVID-19, it makes them more vulnerable to death. And again, this is a very thoughtful process, but we need to start talking in this country about better allocating resources where they're needed, or we will continue to see grievous amounts of death. And I think that you put it very plain. This is the first 100,000. But as I look at past experiences, especially in this country with the 1918 pandemic, we are very likely, it is likely that we will have a second wave. And you and I both know it's a rule that I had as mayor of the city of Newark. It is better to be prepared for a crisis and not have one than have a crisis and not be prepared. And so that's what we should be doing right now, is building up our preparedness for what might come. And that means being proactive and prophylactic in our actions and helping people and building up the capacity of these hospitals that most are likely to see the kind of vulnerable populations that are most hardest hit by this.
I know you got to go in a minute. Any reaction, Senator Booker, to Joe Biden saying last week on the radio show The Breakfast Club with black host Charlamagne Tha God, Biden said, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black. He later apologized. Speaking for yourself, was an apology necessary? And if so, do you accept it?
Look, I've been in public life, Brian, and you might have even covered it. Anybody who's there has gas. It was the end of the, I hope people watched the end of the tape. It was the end of the interview. It was said in a bad joke. But what has stunned me more has been the manufactured outrage and then how people are trying to twist this into something to distract attention from a guy who, in our region, we know. His comments, the current occupant of the White House's comments about the Central Park Five, how he built his political career on attacking Barack Obama's racist attacks on Barack Obama's where he was born, a guy who couldn't condemn Nazis, who's never apologized. Even when people in his own party, leadership in his own party, have condemned the comments, he fails to apologize. So what I see in Joe Biden is a guy who is like all of us, who's made mistakes, who owns up to them and demonstrates what I consider what is a mark of character. Not to go out to the world and say I'm perfect, but when I make mistakes, I stand up and I say them. And I go deeper in understanding and helping to expand other people's understanding of why that was a mistake and why he made a misstep. That shows to me a mark of strength that the current occupant of the White House lacks, and the person that can help us all learn from mistakes, which is at a time that our nation desperately needs more growth and more healthy conversation around issues of race and disparities. This is a guy I have so much confidence will not only go a long way as President of the United States into addressing systematic injustices from our criminal justice system to our healthcare disparities, but more importantly, through his own journey, is going to help us to have greater grace and empathy and love for one another.
The unambivalent Senator Cory Booker. Senator, we always appreciate it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Brian. I really appreciate you, and I love listening to you. So thank you for what you do for our region.
Thank you so much.